Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the pending shutdown of the US government following the latest move by the Republican House to load conditions on keeping the government funded through a continuing resolution the Senate will not even begin to consider until Monday afternoon, 10 hours before the shutdown. Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live, joins us to discuss the latest showdown in the Tea Party's governance by extortion. Then we will speak with the founder and editor of Somalia Report, against whom the so-called White Widow the Kenyan authorities have implicated in the Maul massacre, Samantha Lewthwaite, issued a fatwa before her Twitter went silent on September the 20th. Robert Young-Pelton joins us to clarify the confusion over the 61 people still missing from the Maul attack and the 11 al-Shabaab terrorists the Kenyans claim to have in custody, as well as analyzing the fighting and factions within the failed state of Somalia. Then finally, we will speak with the former Iran specialist on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, Gary Sick, who met with the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani last Wednesday. He joins us to discuss his meeting, the P5 plus one meeting that followed, the phone call between the two presidents after 34 years of hostility, and the meeting at the IAEA last Friday on the possibility of opening up Iran's nuclear sites that is a precondition for removing the crippling sanctions Rouhani wants ended. And joining us now is Steve Clemens, who's the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. And previously, Steve Clemens served as executive director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California and co-founded with Charmans Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clemens.
My pleasure, Ian.
And as I mentioned in the opening, Steve, the Tea Party's governance by extortion seems to be continuing. We're heading for a showdown. The House loaded conditions on the continuing resolution, which has now gone back to the Senate, but the Senate's not even going to consider it until sometime Monday afternoon, which is about 10 hours before the shutdown. So what's it look like to you?
Well, I think it looks like unbelievable immaturity, which is convincing Americans, you know, what they've largely suspected is that their government is dysfunctional, paralyzed, not able to be mature, and it's kind of like, you know, being with, you know, really really crazy people in a car where one of the crazy people's at the driver thing and you know, and saying, hey, this ride over the cliff is going to be a lot of fun. You've got Tea Party Tea Party members of the House out talking to their districts, out tweeting, out sending notes and appearing in the media that they are thrilled that they're going into this crisis, and they say this is what the country needs. And it is it's an extraordinary moment, and it'll be one of those moments, I think, because I don't see anything stopping them right now, that'll go down in American history as one of the, you know, we've had other moments in American history where legislators did horribly, you know, idiotic things, and this will be one of those, and so it'll be one for the history books.
So there's Harry Reid described this as Tea Party anarchy. There have also been reports from from Capitol Hill reporters that these hordes of Republican congressmen in and out of the chamber, there's a wafting smell of liquor. Have you heard those reports?
I have not. That's shocking. If it's true, I mean, if that is true, then this is all much worse than we.
Well, doesn't it feel a bit like a fraternity row kind of exercise? And
they've been behaving as if it's a reckless fraternity night, and you know, unfortunately, we're all going to be paying the price for the hangover, and I think the country, its solvency in the world is really being threatened by what's happening today. Our ability to kind of sit and talk to other countries about democracy is being undermined today enormously. I mean, this is mob. This is the mob side of politics. And, you know, a lot of people said, how did it get this way? And, you know, there's structural reasons. And I go back, you know, and you and I talked about it ages ago of, you know, what Tom DeLay had really engineered in this country, in this kind of, both parties engaged in it, but no one liked Tom DeLay in terms of the extreme redistricting of lines, so that the notion that you would have reasonable, pragmatic moderates in either party able to win these, that what you ended up having is essentially districts that were appealing to more and more populist extremes. And I think combined, I'm going to just say it for what it is, there is a deep racism that's also part of this. People that just hate Barack Obama on every front, that they don't want to negotiate, compromise, win some and lose some in a process of demonstrating that is how democracy works. Their hate of him is so profound that it's driven many of these people and their voters — it's not just the members, it's their voters — to these extreme positions. And the redistricting makes it very difficult to find ways to dislodge them. And so we may have this problem for a long time.
Well, Steve Clemens, you mentioned the full faith and credit of the U.S. being in jeopardy. That's the second bite of the apple that the Republican House and the Tea Party caucus have in mid-October, isn't it? I mean, we're dealing with the first bite of the apple to get rid of Obamacare, and now they're apparently offering in this CR that they went back loaded with conditions, one of which is to get rid of the tax on medical devices. The other one is to delay Obamacare for a year. Then they've already told us that come mid-October, they're going to try all this over again. In fact, the wish list that they have for mid-October, which is, again, government by extortion, is extraordinary. It's every bill that the House sent to the Senate that wasn't passed.
It is government by extortion, and it is, it's a sad moment in our history. I remember, I think it was about a year and a half, 2 years ago, when we were at the, we were in the debt ceiling battles before, and you ended up having a modest decrease by the rating agencies of America's credit rating abroad, in part because of, one, they're concerned about the deficit, but also in part because of the dysfunction within the Congress. And so these sorts of antics were already there. What I was, anyone watching at that time, I was a bit disappointed in the White House, because you saw the Republicans grab onto this debt ceiling debate, which, you have to understand, most Americans knew nothing about. They were largely ignorant that this dynamic was in play and didn't understand that the funding of the government, your funding obligations that the Congress has passed in the past. So these are obligations that the nation has that aren't new ones, this is stuff that these same legislators allowed to go and become law in past years. The White House really never rolled out a campaign to explain the stakes to the country. And I sort of saw the Republicans hijack an issue, dominate it, they continue to dominate it, and the messaging that would kind of inform Americans more broadly of another option has really never really taken hold. So it is an extortion racket for a small number of people who are potentially wrecking the country. And I hope the country wakes up and roars back, because at them and demonstrates in their district. I've been shocked and alarmed at how little focus there is on each one of these individuals and trying to find ways to really reduce and restrict their options for the rest of their lives for what they're doing to the country.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who's the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously he served as executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. But the president said some time back that the only, the holy grail, the only unifying principle amongst Republicans is to deny 40 million Americans health care. And they have, keep talking about it in these apocalyptic terms, which has no connection to reality. It's extraordinary hyperbole, but there's not a lot coming back from the White House to balance the misinformation about Obamacare. I'm astounded that the White House and the Democrats haven't been more assertive in pointing out the obvious, which is that the Republicans, what they're really afraid of is this thing may work, and they are just pulling out all the stops to stop it. And I believe Obama's finally sort of got the message the other day where he made the point, if this thing is so bad, why don't you guys let it go ahead and get voted into law, and then it'll be the train wreck that you say it will be, and then you'll all be heroes, and you'll get elected in 2014 and 2016.
Yeah, there's tape, though, of Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and Rush Limbaugh making exactly that point, where you know, Cruz and Limbaugh are saying, oh, these people will get on, they'll like it so much they won't get off. And so they are saying quite publicly that they know that this will be popular, and then it will be harder and harder to kill it. You have people like John McCain who have been very forceful in their criticism of this strategy and among some other Republican senators. So the Republican Party is divided. And, you know, one would think the Democrats are on their side. I just find it amazing that given the division within Republican ranks, given the power of the Democratic Party, that the White House somehow hasn't engineered a way to break the back of this resistance. And that's what's politically confusing, because we know that not all Republicans are on board with this. And you know, it would seem, but there's a fear out there. I don't know what. It's kind of like a, you know, a kind of fascism on the right or something, that they are afraid of breaking ranks. And so one wonders why is leadership not finding a way to seduce reasonable Republicans? John McCain is behaving very responsibly on this. Why not use that element as a wedge to go after this and garner those votes in a different way? And to, I mean, that may be the end of John Boehner's leadership, but not all of those House members are on board with this.
Right, but Boehner seems to be intimidated by the Tea Party to the point where he won't allow a straight-up and down vote, which would carry the day because of the Democrats would join with a few sensible Republicans.
Failure of leadership on his part.
Right.
And so we're watching a train wreck. We're all being able to foresee and foretell a train wreck. And on the issues of defunding something as profoundly significant as Obamacare, which is kicking in, and despite pretty reasonable positions of the White House, because they know that, you know, they've delayed, you know, certain elements of the implementation of the program to accommodate some of the concerns on the right, that every time the White House gives an inch, the Tea Party sees it as a concession and weakness that animates them further to drive and harder for more. And I think the White House has just got to stop playing nice guy in this.
But what I find extraordinary, Steve Clements, is the contempt that so many of the Republicans and the Tea Party people have for average working Americans and the cavalier attitude that they have about shutting the government down. You keep hearing that the first casualties, and it looks as if this will start on Tuesday, the first casualties will be 800,000 non-essential government employees. Well, since when are the people working for the government non-essential?
They are essential. Every one of them is essential, and they have families. They have children in school. They have bills they have to pay. I have a situation where one of the workers for government happens to, you know, rent an apartment of mine, and this person called and said, you know, I'm going to be one of these people that's laid off. I'm going to have problems with. You know, my rent. And I said, you know, I fully understand that. I fully understand I'm on your side, because I understand what's going on. It's not your fault, and we'll work something out. So there are people out there with real lives. These are not the wealthy aristocrats, you know, that Ted Cruz keeps painting out. These are normal, average, middle-class and lower-middle-class people working in the government who, you know, have things, and they're going to be laid off en masse. It's going to be devastating.
So, Steve Clements, in the last few minutes, let's turn from domestic dysfunction to foreign policy opportunity. We're going to be talking with Gary Sick later in the program, and he met with President Rouhani of Iran last Wednesday. But in general, what's your impression of this possible opening? Because there are enormous strategic implications if we pivot towards Iran away from Saudi Arabia.
Well, Gary is a tremendous asset, so I'm glad he's going to be on the show. I think that there are ways in which the interests of the Saudis and the interests of a reformed and normalized Iran can coexist. you know, there's certainly flames down at the base of that relationship that are going to take a long time to heal and work out. But the Saudis have always been, when Prince Turki Al-Faisal was ambassador here, he always wanted an engagement strategy with the Iranians. He didn't want an appeasement strategy, and certainly they had concerns, but the notion that Saudi Arabia was chomping at the bit for a bombing raid of Iran was not true. I think that what we saw play out this last week in New York with Rouhani and his foreign minister, Javad Zarif, is an extraordinary posture that I think gives us a moment. It would be a great tragedy not to test this potential new course with all the might and creativity that we have. You know, there was an op-ed today by Lindsey Graham and Robert Menendez saying they're not fooled by this Iranian effort to seduce us, that the Iranians are still basically bad. and we can, you know, you could invest. There are a lot of vested interests in maintaining these kind of cold wars with nations for a long time, but it's detrimental to Iran. It's detrimental to the region. It drives up defense spending to absurd levels that undermine the U.S. economy. That if we have leadership inside Iran right now, you know, he went back and had, you know, fruit and shoes thrown at him inside Iran. He's taking a real risk, and people on this side need to take a risk to see whether there is a way to do a deal that would give Iran what it wants, which is peaceful use, reprocessing capacity, and that we get what we want, which is, you know, the law of the land in Iran, allow weapons inspectors to make sure that none of this is weaponized. And that, you know, they'll want other things, we'll want other things, but this is an extraordinarily important opportunity on the level of what the end of the Cold War was or the opening to China. It could be that significant geostrategically.
But isn't there a double standard here, Steve Clements, where we demonize Iran? And I was just watching CNN this morning preparing for the program, and there were guests on talking about Iran being the Iranians being crazy, irrational, dangerous. We don't say that about the Saudi Arabians, even though they are the inspiration for Al-Qaeda sprung out of Saudi Arabia. The Taliban, it was funded and largely created by them. Pakistan has been destabilized. The entire Islamic, the Muslim faith has been radicalized through the Wahhabi sect, which is funded by endless petrodollars and spreads around the world. Al-Shabaab are funded by the Wahhabis, and they're blowing up the Sufi mosques as they do in Pakistan. And now you've got Boko Haram, which means, you know, against Western education. They just murdered a bunch of students sleeping in their dormitories in Nigeria. I mean, it seems to me that we turn a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's duplicity, at the same time attribute all kinds of irrationality and danger to the Iranians.
Yeah, I think that is a reasonable, you know, position to take. That there is a you know, certainly not a consistent position across all of this, with the exception that one of the problems you have throughout the Arab world, and maybe less true in Iran, but I wouldn't want to go too far in that, because you've got very powerful people like Rafsanjani and others, and other folks that have become quite wealthy within the IRGC in Iran, who can operate almost as their own franchises. You have Saudis that are ultra wealthy, who can fly their own planes, manage their own networks, fund their own militias, quite independently of what the Saudi government is doing. And I think sometimes it's complex, particularly when you look at this Wahhabist funding network that comes out of individuals as much as any of the king doling out money to these networks. And so you can have a kind of long-term, reliable partnership with the Saudi government, and they have been reliable in many ways in many of the things that the U.S. foreign policy wanted to do. But at the same time, you've got others that are undermining the stability, undermining the region, and doing, you know, various nefarious things.
Right.
Our,
I forgot to mention,
is that
Syria.
The Iranian government, we've not had a consistent relationship. Right. And what Rouhani is doing is offering the prospect of that. And I think it's a vital opportunity that we need to try to take advantage of.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that my list of Saudi Arabia, I forgot to mention the funding the radical or arming the radical factions in Syria as well, which plays right into Assad's hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that is, you know, that is part of it, but you know, we find, you know, it's one of that's where the elements of realpolitik come in, with the Saudis and the Americans work well together on a lot of fronts, but they're not going to be entirely consistent on this. The Saudis, for instance, were very, very upset with Obama for his stance on Mubarak and the Muslim Brotherhood coming in. So you can have different different strains, but fundamentally have a dynamic with the government as opposed to the rich, high net worth individuals, you know, who go off on their crusades in the government. But, you know, I would basically say if we were looking at us, you know, look at the Koch brothers, look at the Tea Party. I mean, we have a lot we need to be careful of in terms of taking some of this too far, some of what the neoconservatives have funded inside some of these other governments. So,
like the MEC, right. Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Steve Clemons.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clemons, who is the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and served as executive director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California, and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Center. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the founder and editor of the Somalia Report, against whom the so-called White Widow the Kenyan authorities have implicated in the Maul massacre. Samantha Luthwaite issued a fatwa before her Twitter went silent on September the 20th. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgents groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurous. He is the editor and publisher of Somalia Report, founded in 2008, which has 140 correspondents working in Somalia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Thanks, Ian.
And clearly the Kenyan authorities have 11 of these. They say they've got 11 of the terrorists who took over the Westgate Mall and killed 67 people. There are still 61 people missing, according to the Kenyan Red Cross. That's a bit odd, isn't it? Now that they've secured the building, how come they can't account for 61 people?
Well, you're going to see a lot of very strange proclamations coming out of the Kenyan police and government. You know, Africa is famous for incompetence in terms of police and reporting. I was at the site of two bombings in Uganda, and they accused me of being the terrorist because I'd been to both bombings. So they have an amazing lack of sort of common sense. The reality here is that they're keeping very mum on what actually happened in this mall, because there was a significant explosion. The roof was dropped in. They may have killed a large number of hostages in their attempts to get at the terrorists.
So what do we know then about the warnings that apparently the Kenyan press are now talking about, that the cabinet was warned that there'd be attacks between September 13th and the 20th, that the Israelis, who own the mall, had their own warnings as well? And you would think that, I mean, first of all, are these recriminations political, or is there some real evidence that the head of the National Intelligence Service, who will be questioned by Kenya's members of parliament on Monday, screwed up?
Well, I think it's really important to understand what happened there. This is not an al-Shabaab attack per se. There's always been a group there called the Muslim Youth Center, which Samantha Luthwaite was a part of. And it was run by Kenyans.
Let's mention her again. She is what's called the White Widow, right? She's the British woman who was married to a Jamaican fellow who was one of the suicide bombers in the July 7th suicide bombing in the London subways. And then she subsequently married a Kenyan man and ended up in Kenya involved in some of the explosions. And then she, Kenyan authorities questioned her, and she showed them a phony South African passport and was able to escape to Somalia.
That's correct. She ran their website and their Twitter account under NYC Press. And this group was the organization that recruited foreigners from various countries. There's something like 80 from America, 40 from the UK, and who knows, from other countries, and get them up into Somalia where they could join al-Shabaab. And al-Shabaab used to use these foreigners only for suicide attacks. Most of the people that blow themselves up or in car bombs inside Somalia turn out to be foreign volunteers. That group is called al-Hijra, which is meaning journey. And what they would do is take these foreigners, send them up there. But what happened when they killed al-Amriki, the American from Daphne, Alabama, there was a backlash against foreigners. So this is the first time that foreigners have actually taken part in a violent attack against a major target. And if you've been to Nairobi and if you know the embassy crowd and the sort of expat journal crowd, this mall is the single largest, softest target in Nairobi. And the Art Cafe is where everybody met. And strangely enough, it's where HSM Press and NYC used to sit and do their Twitters because they had free internet. So it's kind of ironic that many of the terrorists used to actually go there and shop and eat at the mall. So everybody knew this was a very soft target. Now, in terms of the actual dates, NYC had been infiltrated because it was so easy to get foreigners in there who said they wanted to fight for al-Shabaab. So the only reason why they didn't take action is that they never really took them seriously.
So who is running NYC then? And what's the fate of the White Widow? Is she among the 11 that they're holding that they're not, the Kenyan's authorities aren't saying anything about?
Well, I don't know her fate, and I don't think anybody does. There was a backdoor escape route that was created that goes through a sewer that goes out into the river, and a large number of them probably did escape, but the NYC was essentially set up by a Muslim cleric in Nairobi in Marengo, the poor part of town. And what happened was they began an assassination program in 2011 and 2012 where senior clerics and leaders of this group began to disappear. I mean, they were literally shot in drive-by shootings, and most people believe that was either the Israelis or the Americans, and that's what kind of turned them from a cheerleader group and a support group for al-Shabaab into its own group. So al-Hijra is in itself its own terrorist organization.
But does it have Kenyan support? In other words, is there a diaspora of Somalians or enough?
Now you're getting into history, because if you look at the Swahili coast, which is Mombasa and the area that goes up and down the Indian Ocean there, that is a very old-school Muslim area of black Africans. And then if you go into the interior, you'll find that there's a lot of Christians. And there's always been a little tension between the Muslim groups along the coast, and of course they come into the cities for work, and the Christians. So that has been part of the fulcrum that they've used. If you go back in recent history, you know, the embassy bombings in bin Laden and the attack on the Israeli hotel and the attempt to shoot down an Israeli airliner, there's been a very strong anti-Israeli sentiment there because it's a very popular tourist destination, and a number of the hotels and restaurants are owned by Israeli businessmen. And, of course, the Muslims along the coast take affront to that for whatever reason and have been sort of angered by that and maybe even turned into fundamentalists because of that. So that's really the dynamics in Kenya. But typically, Kenya is a very safe, normal place. There isn't a lot of, you know, demonstrations on the street or sort of anger against foreigners because they provide most of their income.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who is an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspectives on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He is the editor and publisher of Somalia Report, which has been operating since 2008 with 140 correspondents in Somalia. So in terms of Al-Shabaab, which came out of the Muslim League youth group, I guess, funded, I take it, by the Saudi Wahhabis, and its first thing that they did was go and sack, burn, loot, and murder the Sufis, right?
Yeah. Well, you got to be careful because Al-Shabaab is a little bit of a strange bird. You know, Al-Shabaab is not part of Al-Qaeda as we normally know it. Al-Shabaab was, as you know, the radicalized elements of the Islamic courts that ran Somalia after the Ethiopian invasion and before. And they became a splinter group that funded themselves through kind of brutal taxation of the locals. So Al-Shabaab has always supported itself by simply going to businessmen and saying, give us half your income. And they haven't really relied on outsider support that much because it's essentially an internal nationalistic movement. And it's broken into three parts. The Godani is the fellow from Hargeisa. He's an Isak tribesman. He is the most fundamental, and he is considered sort of the bad guy, but the one that aligned himself to Al-Qaeda twice. Robo used to be the leader, but he's down south, and he has his loyalties amongst Baidoa and Bay Area, where Al-Shabaab is fighting now. And then Dahir Always, who was sort of a cleric that led the Islamic courts, has actually defected to the government. And there was a strong pressure on Robo and Godani to split, and they began fighting amongst each other. So what you're seeing now is actually Al-Shabaab's running out of oxygen in southern Somalia, and they're looking for something to open up some type of new front. So when MYC or Al-Hijra decided to do the mall attack, that essentially shifted the war down south because it's the Kenyans that are doing most of the fighting in the very southern part, which is called Jubaland in Somalia.
So what is the foreign component here? We've apparently, according to the FBI, at least 20 men have left Minnesota since 2007 to join Al-Shabaab. And recently there have been reports of foreigners fighting with Al-Shabaab being murdered in some kind of fratricide.
Yeah, well, obviously the number is much higher than that. They estimate it's around 80 that have left from the U.S. to volunteer and go fight. The problem is that the Somalis don't like the foreigners, and Shabaab is actually trying to cleanse itself of the foreigners because that's what makes the locals reject it as sort of a war run by foreign mercenaries. And as you mentioned in the beginning, most of their attacks were against Sufis, and a large number of Somalis are not only not aligned with the Sunni Wahhabist principles, but they're actually very educated, worldly people who have diaspora and relatives all around the world. So Somalia is actually a very bad place for Al-Qaeda to wage a war because the people just don't want them there. The foreigners are an extra aggravation, as you saw with Al-Amriki or the fellow from Daphne, Hamani. He actually tried to start his own little division because he felt that the Al-Shabaab was too brutal and too draconian on the locals, and he actually had a following in the south there for a while until they killed him, and Godani had him killed. And the foreigners just don't fit in. They're from Minneapolis, they're from Norway, they're from Oshawa. They're sort of soft-handed, angry little kids who go there. They have no military skills. And that's why they strapped on with a suicide vest or put in a car full of bombs and told to go drive up to a checkpoint.
So just to get some historical context on the agony of this country that's often referred to as a failed state, Robert Young-Pelton, again, the editor and publisher of Somalia Report, which has operated since 2008 with 140 correspondents in Somalia. The invasion by the Ethiopians, which was a disastrous move, which was done by the Bush administration, the neocons, one of their brilliant ideas, like the invasion of Iraq, that created a big backlash because the Christian Ethiopians aren't particularly popular. My understanding is that also in terms of foreign interference. You've got the African Union Army with 4,000 Kenyan troops coming up from the south. You've got the U.S. and the Special Forces with the drones operating in nearby Djibouti. And then you've got the Eritreans, who are secular and Marxist, nevertheless supporting the al-Shabaab and other Islamic fundamentalists. Is that the mosaic?
You described a very good soap opera for television. Somalia, as you probably know, is broken down by clans. So there is a government down south in Mogadishu, but each region has its own agenda. And, of course, its neighbor has its own agenda. And just to make it short and sweet, the Islamic court system actually swept in, cleaned out the warlords, very similar to the Taliban in Afghanistan, and for a brief moment set up this Wahhabist sort of caliphate in which people were quite happy and there was no crime, et cetera, et cetera. The Ethiopians came in with American support and got rid of them, and that's what created al-Shabaab as this little sort of splinter, which means, you know, the boys or the youth, this little splinter kill thrill group. And then what happened is there was America paying Uganda to send troops under what they call AMISOM to then push out al-Shabaab in the south. The Ethiopians came in from the west. And then when they realized that they had no sort of anvil in the south, the Americans convinced the Kenyans, who had never fought a war before and had no skills, to then invade from the south. That was about 2 years ago. Well, if you live in the region, there's a place called Jubaland, which is what the British colonials set up as a buffer between the cattle-raiding Somalis and the nice, happy Kenyan pastoralists. Well, they're recreating that now around the port of Kismayo in the south. And that's what al-Shabaab does not want, because that's their heartland. That's where they come from. That's where Robo's from. Godani's from the north, from the extreme north, which, if you look at Somaliland, it's actually its own country. And if you look at Puntland, it's not its own country, but it's separate from the southern part. Godani only has support through foreign jihadi linkages, and that's why twice he said he's linked to bin Laden and al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera. But he actually has very little support. He doesn't get tons of money from, you know, Gulf Emirates. His family lives in the UAE in Sharjah, and he constantly is getting marginalized every time he tries to get Somalis to support him because they don't want him. So he's trying Kenya now to see if that gets some kind of traction, and then he's trying to ignite the idea that, you know, Somalis really don't care, so now it's Muslim Kenyans hating against Christian Kenyans and et cetera, et cetera. So he's trying to inflame that little division down there.
Well, just in closing, now, you mentioned Puntland in the north that's on both the Indian Ocean and the Gulf of Aden. That's relatively stable. I understood there for a while an ex-CIA guy and a former Reagan administration ambassador, Pierre Prospero, were pretty much running that place like something out of Rudyard Kipling.
They weren't running it, but they set up what the UN calls the largest and best-trained military force in Somalia, in what they call the Puntland Marine Force. That's Eric Prince's project.
Eric Prince being the former head of Blackwater.
Right, and that got shut down last June. But yes, both Somaliland and Puntland are stable, and the only areas that are really sort of in chaos is Galmudug, which is in the center where the pirates used to be, and the very south where al-Shabaab is still fighting against AMISOM. But the reality is that al-Shabaab is not anywhere else except in the very south, and they're slowly being pushed out of the south by the Kenyans, and the Ugandans have taken them out of Mogadishu. So they have to go somewhere. So I think the goal with the Kenyan raid, or the attack on the Westgate Mall, was to try to push the focus of the fighting into the border between Kenya and Somalia.
Well, Robert Young-Pelton, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. His books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, Three Worlds Gone Mad, License to Kill, Hired Guns and the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. He's the editor and publisher of Somalia Report, which has operated since 2008 with 140 correspondents in Somalia. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the former Iran specialist on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, Gary Sick, who met with the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani last Wednesday. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gary Sick, a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute and the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, and October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. He just met with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani last Wednesday. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Sick.
Ian, it's very good to be back with you.
And what was your impression of Hassan Rouhani?
Well, he is a he's a very serious, he smiles a lot, but he's a very serious guy with a real measure of gravitas. He's obviously somebody who knows what he's talking about. He's fully in command of his brief. He understands English very well. He chose to speak in Persian, but he listened in English without translation and handled himself extremely well. He has had a history that is rather remarkable. He's been involved in every major security and policy decision on the part of the Iranian government, really since the Rafsanjani period, early in the immediate aftermath of Khomeini's death. So this is a guy who has been part of the system all the way along, but who got elected to, in fact, bring the system forward. Ahmadinejad, his predecessor, was a catastrophe for Iran in every way, in terms of its image, in terms of its public policy, in terms of its economy, certainly in terms of its world image. And Rouhani has got the very unenviable task to try to come in and change that. So I think part of what we were seeing during his trip here was his attempt to say, look, despite what you've seen, heard, and thought in the past, Iran can be, in fact, a legitimate partner for you in talking about not only the nuclear issue, which we are anxious to get to actually settle and bring to a resolution, but also on other issues such as Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and many, many other things. So he was here basically to convince people that he was a legitimate interlocutor, and I would say that for those who met with him, and up to and including Secretary of State Kerry and President Obama, I would say he had a very significant amount of success.
And Gary Sick, my understanding is he's something of a consummate insider within the revolutionary government, and which is obviously...
He's an insider who got elected as an outsider. It's not the first time that's happened. We have lots of people in Washington who run as outsiders, criticizing the government when they are, in fact, insiders and they've been part of the government all along. That's a standard way of doing it. It you don't see it so often in Iran. But the reality is that he reflects the views of the former presidents Rafsanjani and Khatami, both of whom, and particularly Khatami, was recognized by everybody as a reformer who wanted to change the system and wanted to, you know, basically be more tolerant, leave room, much more room for women's rights, civil rights, and the like. And he, and it was Khatami's endorsement of Rouhani that, in effect, galvanized his campaign and, in effect, got him elected. So he was elected because of his views, not because of his background. His background, however, which he was, in fact, the personal representative of the Supreme Leader on their National Security Council for the last, basically, quarter of a century. And as such, he knows the Supreme Leader about as well as anybody in the business. And it does mean his access as an insider, a trusted insider, is that he knows how to get things done. That was the big problem with Khatami, who was a real outsider, who had not really been part of either the revolution or the government for any period of time, and was not at all versed in foreign policy and security issues. It wasn't that he wasn't smart and capable, it was that they didn't take him seriously, and they basically undercut him from the beginning. The hardliners did. Mm-hmm. As we've seen with Rouhani, he came back to Iran after this trip, and some people greeted him with cheers, but there was a small group of people, protesters, who said, death to America, don't talk to the Americans, and so forth. So he's got a group of hardliners in his country that have to be dealt with. He's in a better position to do that than really any president that Iran has had up until this point.
And that's the assumption, is that because he's got close connections to the Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Quds, he even met, I believe, with the Iran-Contra, the secret delegation from the Reagan administration, with Bud McFarlane and Oliver North, who brought the cake and the pistol in the infamous Iran-Contra.
The people have made that claim. It's not confirmed.
I see.
And the people who really know the Iran-Contra issue very well think that this is an exaggeration. But if he did, it was, you know, you take it as evidence of the fact that here he is,
right,
basically for his entire career, has been promoting the idea of U.S.-Iran relations, has actually been willing to meet right. with, talk with Americans under any circumstances. And actually, his later career was much more significant, where he, in fact, was the nuclear negotiator for Iran in the 2003 to 2005 period, when they actually did make an agreement with the Europeans to they actually suspended all of their enrichment and made an offer that the Europeans thought was really very good to basically cap their enrichment activities and their nuclear program. That was turned down by the Americans. And so, in effect, his history has been that he has been pushing the idea of settling the nuclear issue, getting it off the table, taking care of that, and then moving to a different level of, in fact, involvement with the international community. He has been thwarted at least two or three times by the Americans in that process. So he didn't come here naive and wide-eyed. He came understanding that he was going to have to put up and also had to beware of being betrayed. And that may help explain why he didn't rush to have a handshake with President Obama until he got some idea of what he could expect, whether the Americans were in fact prepared to deal with him at an appropriate level.
And again, I'm speaking with Gary Sick, a senior research scholar at the Columbia University's Middle East Institute, and he served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis, and he just met with Iran's new president, Rouhani, last Wednesday. So since then, of course, you had the P5+1 meeting that apparently went very well. And then you had on Friday the IAEA meeting in Vienna. that apparently went very well as well. They're talking about meeting again in mid-October. So what is going on, in your opinion, Gary Sick, with Iran's nuclear program? Because they've taken such a hit over it with these crippling sanctions, which clearly Rouhani wants to remove, and the Iranian people desperately want removed. And then so are they basically, do they want the same kind of capability that the Japanese have, where they have the ability, they have the tremendous enrichment ability, but to move to a bomb, they could do it very quickly, but they don't want to do it?
I think they will settle for something far, far less than the Japanese. The Japanese basically are on the very brink of having, if they decided to have a nuclear weapon, they could do it almost, you know, a friend of mine joked that the Japanese, if they made up their mind, could have a bomb in a long weekend. I don't think Iran anticipates or do they particularly, they certainly don't expect that that will be the outcome of the negotiations. But they do want to have formal recognition of their right to enrich uranium and to run their own program and to provide their own supplies for their own power plants and the like, because they say that they can't trust the international community to provide those supplies under normal circumstances. So they want to have a degree of autonomy. That will mean that Iran will have the capacity at some level of capacity to break out, that is, to actually move from their existing situation with being inspected and monitored by the IAEA. They would be able, if they took a decision, they would be able to build a bomb. The question is, how long would it take? They have the capability now. I mean, if they decided to go for a bomb today, they could certainly have a bomb within, say, a year. And some people think it's faster than that. I personally don't think they could get all the pieces together and put a bomb together. Certainly not a deliverable bomb in less than a year, and it could be longer than that. I think that is what we're going to be negotiating about now. What really happened during this last week was that from the meeting between Secretary of State Kerry and Zarif, the foreign minister, on Thursday, that was the first time that an American Secretary of State had sat down to talk substantively with an Iranian, basically since before the Iranian Revolution. That was 34 years ago. This meeting was extraordinary because it, first of all, took place initially at the IAEA meeting, at the P5 plus one meeting, where Zarif made a big presentation. Then at the end of that, about 20 minutes or 25 minutes of presentation, there was a roundtable discussion about the proposals that Iran had put on the table. And at the end of that, Kerry leaned over to him and said, you know, would you have time to talk for a few minutes? And the two of them went out by themselves to another room, no note takers, nothing. And they were in the room for at least 30 minutes. And when they came out, they were both smiling. And clearly, they had at least satisfied each other that they had something useful to talk about. And then that was then capped by the next day, when President Obama picked up the phone in the Oval Office and called Rouhani on his way to the airport and wished him a good trip, and they exchanged a couple of words and some substantive words, but then at the end of the thing, Obama said goodbye to him in Persian, and he said, have a good day in English. That is extraordinary. There's nothing like that has happened, certainly in more than about 35 years, any contact whatsoever, let alone something of that nature. The ice has started to break between Washington and Tehran. Now, how far that will go and how fast remains to be seen. I don't think we should get ahead of ourselves. But the next meeting is, as you say, the P5 plus one with Zarif there will be meeting in Geneva on the 15th of October. And a few days after that, the IAEA will be meeting either in Geneva or Vienna, I'm not sure. In both of those cases, Iran will be coming with a set of concrete proposals. I think what has happened thus far is that Iran has said, here is the end game that we would like to see. We would like to negotiate with you knowing that this is where we want to end up, and spelling that out. That's not public, and we don't have the details. And I believe the Americans agreed to that. So if you've got some kind of an end state in mind where you know that this is where we would like to go, then you can begin to put together a step-by-step plan about how you're going to get there. And it seems to me if that initial end plan is accepted, that's where we are now, and the negotiations from now on will be about, all right, how do we get there? That's not to say that it's easy. It's just that it is eons ahead of where we were just 2 weeks ago.
Well, just in the last minute, Gary Sick, Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel will be the last to speak at the UN in this General Assembly session, and he'll meet with President Obama at the White House on Monday. The Iranians are trying to tie the Israel nuclear arsenal to the situation that they're in. Is that going to work? I mean, the Israelis clearly have a very, very advanced arsenal. They tested a thermonuclear device on the 22nd of September 1979 off the coast of Namibia, which is, for all intents and purposes, a neutron bomb. So they've got a very advanced arsenal, from my understanding. Is that ever going to come on the block?
It's certainly not contingent. I mean, the negotiations that will be held with the P5+1 do not require Israel to give up its nuclear capability. But Iran is also the chair, presently, of the non-aligned movement. And while he was in New York, Rouhani made a speech saying, don't forget that there's only one country in the entire Middle East that has not signed the non-proliferation treaty. And that country is Israel. And he called Israel by its name, not the Zionist entity. And I think it's clear that when Mr. Netanyahu speaks this week, he will try to undo what was done with Rouhani here. He will try to cast doubts on his reliability, on his honesty, and so forth, and will call for all kinds of steps with regard to Iran. And I think that what Rouhani did while he was here was to remind people that Iran is not the only country in the Middle East which either has a potential capability of building a bomb, but actually has a stockpile of nuclear weapons.
Gary Sick, I'm afraid we've
going to hear that.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure to talk to you, Ian, as always.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Gary Sick, who's a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute. He is served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. He just met with Iranian President Rouhani last Wednesday. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.